Welcome to the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, a show dedicated to the artistry and science of sports field management and celebrating the groundskeepers who create those masterpieces. The Diamond Da Vinci podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. On this inaugural edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, like much of the U.S., we're focusing on drought conditions. We're going to talk science and strategy for drought and dry weather. During the meteorology minute, we'll take a look at the severe drought in the southwest U.S. and ask meteorologist Craig Edwards to explain the weather patterns behind it and whether he sees any relief in the near future.
In our turf science segment, we'll dive deep into the physiological responses of turf to the stresses of drought, and we'll review a scientific article about turf management in under droughty conditions. But don't worry, folks, we can keep it interesting, I promise.
Yeah, geek out. And today's out-of-the-park interview looks to California, where we'll discuss management strategies with both Darren Budak, Assistant Park and Recreation Director for the City of Crisfield, California, and Eric Hansen, Head Groundskeeper with the Los Angeles Dodgers. They'll tell us how the drought is affecting them and what management practices they have in place to maintain their fields with reduced water availability.
You know, Paul, I always find it fascinating to see how different managers do the same work, and I think it's even more so fascinating when we're talking about fields under stress conditions.
And I think it's fascinating that you're fascinated about this fascinating subject. We're going to have all that and more on this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. And hello, everybody. I'm Paul Zawaska, your host for the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. And I'm joined by the talented Teresa Beyer, my very talented co-host and producer of the show. And if I say talented one more time, it's just because she's really talented.
Really, really talented. Hey, y'all.
Well, I can't tell you how excited we are about working together to bring the show to all of you folks out there, all of you Diamond Da Vinci's or artists that we call groundskeepers or sports field managers.
We really are. We've been working on this for a while, and, you know, first shows are always full of glitches, but...
And 57 takes.
And 57 takes that you fortunately don't have to listen to. But we did.
Oh, well, such is the life of starting up a new show.
Yeah.
Well, we have a theme usually to each show, and the theme this week is going to be about the drought, especially in parts of the southwest U.S. where it's getting quite serious and quite severe. You know, 47% of California's landmass right now is rated at exceptional level for droughts, which is the highest level you can get or the severest level you can get according to the USGS. And 46% is rated at either severe or extreme. So basically this covers all of California, and it's severely impacting the sports field management in that state. Over 37 million people in California are affected by this water shortage. On April 1st, the USGS survey of the snowpack in the Sierra Mountain Range found that snowpack was only around 5% of normal. I mean, that right there, that number just is amazing.
Wow.
5% of normal. The April measurement
skiers
is
to do.
Yeah, well, but apparently they're using cardboard on mud slopes, I think.
Yeah.
The April measurement is the most important because historically that's the time of the year that it has the deepest snowpack just before the melting begins, and that feeds, of course, the thirsty population and the agriculture of California. This year's levels are the lowest since records began back in the early 50s. The snowpack is usually responsible for 1/3 of California's water supply.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I have family out there. My husband's family is out there, and I also do a lot of work now in the agriculture industry, and not just in turf, but in ag. And because of that, I'm really curious to kind of see where they start deciding where to draw the line on who gets what water and when. You know, there's a part of me that is rooting for my family, and then there's the other part of me that likes to eat. And, you know, so it's interesting to see how politically they're going to handle all of that, you know, and turf grass managers and golf course guys are going to probably get caught in the middle.
Well, it's going to be one heck of a tug of a war out there. There's no doubt about it, because there's so many different businesses that need water. Then there's the regular population that needs water just for day-to-day life. So as it dwindles, it's going to get messier and messier out there.
Yeah, it's not pretty.
Well, after all those facts, it's time for our first segment today. Well, it's actually our first segment ever on this Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. It's time for the Meteorology Minute.
Well, all right, it might be closer to 5 or 10 minutes, but we went with Meteorology Minute because it sounded cooler than saying, let's discuss meteorology for 5 or 10 minutes.
Okay. That's a little geeky again. Well, joining us on the phone for the M&M segment, we have Craig Edwards, who is the staff meteorologist for the Twins, but he's also the retired chief meteorologist for the National Weather Service Twin Cities office. Craig, welcome to the show.
Nice to be on to give you some information here about what I know about a drought.
Well, we're looking forward to it because all we know is that it hurts the turf.
Yeah. Right.
So what can you tell us about California? You know, I know back in 2011 they were sitting in pretty good shape. They had a lot of snow cover up in the mountains there, which helps to feed the masses down there. But over the past 3 years since then, they've been really suffering and haven't had the rainfall or the snowfall that they needed.
Yeah, meteorologists and climatologists have tried to partner the El Nino concept, which is the warming waters of the Pacifics and the tropics, and correlate that to a predominant weather condition, mainly through the fall and winter season. And last year at this time, they were predicting a possibility of a weak or moderate El Nino that would help the drought situation in California, and that never developed. So we consider a weak El Nino to be about a half degree Celsius sea surface temperature anomaly in the eastern or in the Pacific waters off the African coast or in the tropical Pacific. So that didn't happen. It didn't gain enough strength. And so what we're seeing this year is a warming of the temperatures now that's up to 1 degree Celsius. And they're forecasting conditions up to a degree and a half or perhaps 2 degrees, which would make it a moderate to strong El Nino as we head into late summer. Now the difficult question here is if that will last through the winter season. So there's not much of a correlation or not much of a help of an El Nino in the summer months in California where they're typically dry anyway. So we're going to have to see a pattern that sets up with an El Nino and about a 65% opportunity for that. And the correlation with that would be a return to above normal precipitation in most of California and the Northwest.
Yeah, I worked in Baltimore for 15 years as the head groundskeeper, and we had a couple of pretty serious droughts in the years I was out there. The last one, in, I think it was 1998, which was very serious. We had a lot of our reservoirs were down considerably, over 50% down, and we were hitting some of the tough times that California now. And on the East Coast, you rely on remnants of hurricanes typically to be the drought busters for out east. And obviously on the West Coast, for them, it's typically going to be an El Nino season, winter season that you're hoping for to help solve those issues. And like you said, they were expecting one last fall and they didn't end up with one. And now, like you say, it looks like we're getting into one for around this summer. And that doesn't necessarily help them. Actually, if anything, it increases the chance of drought busters for the East Coast because if I recall correctly, El Ninos typically increase the amount of activity in the Atlantic for hurricane season.
Yeah, we're still trying to get a handle on the El Nino correlation with hurricanes, and so that's a more difficult situation. But a El Nino winter is usually a milder than normal winter here in the upper Midwest of the Minnesota region, and that usually spells temperatures well above normal for the December, January, February months, which some people tend to enjoy, and other people say, well, we live up in Minnesota, so we can enjoy the cold temperatures. But I think the question that you bring around here that is quite interesting is that it's almost like if it can't be dry everywhere. If it's dry in California, some places have to be wet. So I know that they had that big snowfall out in Boston during the winter season with a lot of moisture with that. So California had the drought and Boston had the snow. Now, what might happen is we set up with an El Nino winter coming into 2015-2016 is that we could develop a wet conditions in California and very warm conditions in the upper Midwest and maybe dry conditions elsewhere in the country. So it seems like we can't please everybody, but I think in this situation that we want to serve as much optimism as we can to the people of California. And I know the Pasadena Jet Propulsion Laboratory is pretty giddy about this warm blob of water that's developed, and they're thinking about a 65% to 70% chance that it's going to turn into a strong El Nino by the time we get to fall, and that would be very good news. Looking forward to moisture increases in California.
Yeah, and the only downfall to that whole thing is they've had 3 years of very serious. Well, actually, the past year has been really the most serious so far out in California, and of course that makes for really dry soils that aren't going to take water too well when it first comes in. And so when those heavier rains from the El Nino come in the wintertime, you start seeing mudslides. You know, it's like California can't win for the life of them.
Well, that's it. We need the rain, but we need a gentle overnight rain. And one of the things that I've been reading up on is that this drought has been persistent long enough, leading into portions of even to Arizona, where the vegetation and the trees are not just suffering, that they're dying. So once a shrub or a tree dries out, you can throw as much water on there as you can, and if it's dead, it won't come back. So
some of the
concern is that the foliage dries out to the point where it dies through the summer months, then you start getting these situations where the water is not being absorbed by the vegetation. You have total runoff, which leads to mudslides. So it seems like there's a never-ending conundrum out there in California weather-wise.
And of course, the fire season, the fire year is just getting started out there. And with the situation the way it is, that's going to increase more issues there, more fires. Again, those burn up the underlying brush and things like that, which helps to stabilize those soils. So more fires means more areas that you could possibly have mudslides and things like that.
Here,
so that, you know, everything just magnifies itself.
Right, and we're going into the warm season, so you have increasing opportunities for evaporation, longer daylight, higher temperatures. So you're going to exacerbate the problem with going into the summer months, and then, of course, the need for water goes up when you start growing agriculture through the summer months. So it's going to be a problem that looks to be going to get worse before it gets better as we head on into June, July, and August. And I think we're going to have very hopeful watch for coming into the fall season and the winter season.
Well, let's hope we can get them that relief, even if it means a mudslide or two. There comes a point where you've got to get water over to the southwest just to live.
Right.
And it may mean some sacrifices in some ways, but let's hope El Nino builds for the late fall and into the winter and get some serious water into those areas that need them. Craig, I appreciate you joining us today, and hopefully we'll be talking with you again soon.
Sounds good. Have a good day.
Thank you, Craig.
And now I have to provide some disclosure here. As some of you may know, I'm an employee of our sponsor, Beacon Athletics. And one thing I'm very proud about with Beacon is our innovative solutions we've developed over the years for the sports of baseball and softball. When I came to Beacon after I left the Orioles back in 2000, I talked with our engineer, Jim Merland, and I told him the first thing I'd like us to do is design a better performing chalker. And after about a year of research and development and testing, we introduced the Streamliner Chalker, which at the time revolutionized the chalking industry with beautifully consistent lines and variable control chalk flow, which ended up saving a lot of organizations 30% or more on their chalk expenditures. Over the years, we've released other groundbreaking products like the Phantom Tension Cages, the Instant Eye Batter's Eye, the Beacon Field Weights and Tarp Cart System. And now this past January, we introduced the industry shocking Sweet Spot Tamp System. It just kind of makes you wonder, what are we going to come up with next? Isn't it time you check out Beacon Athletics? Look us up on the web at www.beaconathletics.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or call us at 800-747-5985. Don't be left out on our next innovation. Well, this is my favorite part of the podcast. This is when we get to talk to one or more of our colleagues and take a close look at a subject that either we're preparing for in the upcoming season or that we've all dealt with in the past. Now, as we talked about in the last segment, it's been a little dry out in the desert southwest in California over the past 3 years, and it's becoming increasingly critical for all those who live and work there. On April 1st this year, the governor of California, Jerry Brown, imposed a mandatory 25% reduction in water usage for everyone in the state, both residential and commercial. Now, needless to say, this is going to negatively impact many of our Diamond Da Vincis out there who are taking care of ball fields and other sports fields. So let's get a feel for what they're dealing with. Darren Budak, who is the assistant director for the City of Bakersfield Recreation and Parks Department. He's with us today, and he's right smack dab in the middle of the worst of the drought there in Bakersfield. Darren, welcome to the Diamond Da Vincis podcast.
Oh, thank you very much.
I got to ask you, Darren, what's the population of Bakersfield? Do you know offhand?
Yeah, City of Bakersfield is approximately 350,000 people.
350,000 people. And so
the ninth largest city in California.
Are you working at getting up to number one, or are you going to pretty much...
Well, I don't know if we'll catch the likes of those. We don't have the coast and the draw that some of the other California cities have, but we like it here.
Well, for that size population, then how many acres of parkland do you folks maintain? And out of that number, how many of those acres of parkland are sports fields?
We maintain approximately 550 what I would call active parkland. You know, we have a lot of passive and open area on top of that. And then within that, I would say probably 10, 15% of that would be sports fields, either soccer, softball, some of your other sports.
Now, in your situation, because of where you folks are, is most of that irrigated then, the sports fields?
Oh, absolutely. Where we're at, if you don't have irrigation, it doesn't grow.
Oh, no. Yeah.
We average less than 6 inches of water or rain per year.
Oh, wow. Oh.
Now, see, I can't imagine that living where I've lived all my life.
if we get a tenth of an inch, it's a big rain event.
It's a big celebration there, yeah.
It is.
So your budget then that you allocate each year for water is probably pretty huge, I'm guessing.
Yeah, our annual budget for irrigation is about $2.5 million.
Wow.
Ooh. That's a little bit more than what I spend for water in my Little League complex. That's for sure. Now, so with the situation that's in hand now, you've gone through these past couple of years of receiving less and less rainfall, and obviously you're now in the point where you are right in the middle of the worst of it. You're in the exceptional drought, what they're calling the exceptional drought. There in California. So what are the conditions of your fields right now? You've been able to water up until this point?
Well, we started last year, actually. The governor had asked for some voluntary reductions from all of California starting last year, and we started reducing our water beginning of, I would say, June, about a year from today we started reducing. So we've been dialing it back and trying to not irrigate as much some of our passive areas, you know, some of our streetscapes, our medians and those areas. But as far as the sports fields, we've tried to maintain them in as safe a condition as possible. Yeah. But with the new restrictions, and one thing that's just came down to us, our city council passed it last week, is we have a new mandate. And the governor, on top of the restrictions, the 25% that everybody's very well aware of, each community was looked at independently, and Bakersfield got the bad news that we are being held to a 36% reduction in our water. So it went from a nightmare to nightmare times three.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
so what kind of plans have you fully figured out your plans as far as how you're going to reach that goal yet, or...?
Well, we have not fully. Of course, we're grabbing the low-lying fruit. Here in Bakersfield, we have spray parks. And I don't know if everybody's familiar with them.
Basically,
they're just elements. We open them up to the public, and they run about 8 hours a day, 7 days a week throughout the summer, and they're heavy water users. So they are closed this year. We've closed all them down for the entire year. And in our community, where it's very common to be 100 to 105 degrees, that's going to be a big hit for people's ability to get out there and cool off. So that was our one of our first steps. And then, like I said, now we've gone to the point where we are letting turf in non-programmed areas. We're letting it, what we're calling it, brown is the new green in Bakersfield. Yeah. So we're browning up everywhere.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. The so you're not even watering to try and keep it alive. I mean, I got to assume Bermuda grass, like bluegrass, can go for a while without water.
I'm guessing
you're Bermuda there, correct? You're all Bermuda?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We have our winter grass that, you know, will come in with the rise, but now at this time of the year, we're 100% Bermuda.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say 100%, but
right.
Majority.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can go probably a couple months without water on those things, and the Bermuda is going to come back fine. You know, the thing about Bermuda is you can't kill the stuff to begin with.
Well, so, you know, we always joke about that.
That's what us Northerners believe.
We always joke about that. You know, in the majority of the country, Bermuda is considered a weed, and we mow it, water it, and manicure it, and call it a turf. So, yeah. But, yeah, it can sustain, you know, long periods of low to no water, and it will recover. The challenges we're having is, intermixed with all of our turf, you know, we have our trees and our shrubs and other things that, you know, can't go long periods. So we're having to be very creative on how we irrigate those areas to maintain those different plants, because we don't want to see any long term. Like you say, turf you can recover from fairly quickly, but you start losing trees and stuff, you might not see that damage mm-hmm. for 1, 3, 5 years down the road, and then it's too late at that point.
Well, and that brings up actually a really good question. Have you folks figured out a hierarchy of, you know, what's going to get water first? Is it for your parks? Is it going to be the trees? Are they top priority, or is it sports fields, or you know, other things, planting beds, or, you know, have you guys kind of figured out a strategy of who gets priority or what gets priority?
Yeah, we have. You know, we've looked at, you know, all of our program sites. You know, safety is our biggest concern. So we will maintain the irrigation in those areas to make sure, you know, whatever event we're programming there, whether it's a, you know, an all-weekend festival or a softball tournament or soccer, what have you, we make sure those facilities are getting proper irrigation. And then it sort of trickles down from there. Depending on the location and species, you know, our trees and our ground cover will be second, and turf, open turf areas in passive parks, streetscapes, medians, they are at the bottom. And actually, I would say majority, if not all of them, have been turned off or to the point where we're just exercising valves maybe once a week just to make sure everything's still operating.
So have you seen at this point in time in your particular jurisdiction, have you seen any drop off in quality of your fields? It sounds like you're still watering. I'm sure you've cut back some watering on these fields at this point.
Oh,
right?
Yes. Yeah. And I need to clarify that. We definitely are cutting back, and we're starting to see it now. Our fields are as lush and green as we like to keep them. They're what we consider a minimum level. We do have some brown areas in our outfields and on our soccer fields that normally we would jump all over and address right away, but we're accepting that as the norm for now.
Sorry, Paul.
Go ahead.
Do you guys have any synthetic fields yet?
No, synthetic, you know, as you can imagine here in Bakersfield is a tough sell with our temperatures. It's, you know,
a little hot.
When people are out wanting to get on and use those things and it's 105, 110 degrees outside, there's a whole different list of safety concerns that we have to deal with. So
absolutely.
We have not ventured into the synthetic turf arena yet.
Well, and what a lot of folks don't know is how much more water it can take, especially if you're looking at a hot climate. The amount of water that you need in order to cool down the plastic is pretty significant.
Yeah, and some of the studies and some of the information I've read about is, you know, the cooling effect is minimal, mm-hmm. to the extent of however long you cool it for, that's how long it's going to last. If you irrigate, yes. and cool it down for an hour, it's going to be cool for an hour.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's very short-lived, because I've actually toyed around with that just to see how long it takes for the temperature to come back. And usually it's only 10, 15 minutes. The newer artificial turfs just heat up actually way faster than the very old AstroTurf products mm-hmm. that were out there in the old days. Because of the increased number of leaf blades, there's more surface area to heat up quicker, and of course the rubber granules, if there's rubber in there, doesn't help either. That also brings.
Yeah, that makes sense. So yeah, we're not there yet. Again, that would be tough to justify. We would get some good use 6 months a year, but the other six we might be very limited use on those facilities. And they still have maintenance, and that's, you know, whether it's irrigation or maintenance, there's still maintenance. It's not a, you know, set it and forget it type deal that a lot of people like to think it is.
That's good that, you know, your group seems to be ahead of the game on that. That's always good to hear, especially probably from your area. You know, it's nice mm-hmm. knowing that you're not having to re-educate a lot of folks.
Well, and that's the thing. The people of California and the desert Southwest are used to conserving water. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe mm-hmm. not at this rate, but, you know, in a lot of cases, I would be willing to bet that their irrigation systems are very up to date. You know, we'll have the latest and greatest things that will make sure that every ounce of water that they're putting on those fields are going exactly to that. You know, it's funny you were talking about you've had to come to learn to deal with having some brown spots in the field, and just how far we've come from, you know, when I was growing up, the 60s and 70s, where you had multi-purpose stadiums that had both football and baseball. And then back then, when you watched a ball game in October, or in September, when football overlapped, it was acceptable to have football where on a Major League Baseball field on TV, mm-hmm. and people would see that, and they would think that's acceptable. Nowadays, you can't have a blade of grass out of place on a Major League field at any time, or an NFL field.
And I will take that one step further. You know, through the Sports Turf Managers Association, I've had the opportunity to volunteer and work at the Little League World Series each year, and the professionals and the fields that those young men are getting, young men and women are having a chance to play on. I mean, that is a major league field. I mean, nothing's spared. They're playing on the best of the best. And I'm like you, not too long ago, it was acceptable to have multi-sports, and that's just, that's the way it was, but not now. You've got to have very specific use, and it's got to be perfect in every aspect.
And that presents a problem, because what people sitting down in their living room watching a game on Major League Baseball or NFL football or, you know, soccer, any of those major events, they see these perfect fields, and now they come to your parks and they expect that. And that's one of the problems we've run into with the improvements that the Sports Turf Managers Association has done over the years, and the improved education of groundskeepers, that they've been able to create these perfect fields. Now they get to the park levels where the money's not there to provide those kind of surfaces, and they expect those kind of things. You know, I'm in the same situation. I've got my Little League complex is perfect. The Little League infields are major league quality. Teresa's seen them. She knows.
Yeah.
You know, and parents say, well, these kids don't know. They go other places, and they, you know, they don't know any better. And the truth is, those kids realize a good field when they walk on it. But, you know, we're setting up standards that force the park and rec directors, you know, that you have to do better because everybody sees these higher end fields. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that you tell me that, you know, well, yeah, we've got to get used to seeing a couple brown spots, but you don't have a choice at this point in time.
Yeah, and it's just, it's the right thing to do, you know, regardless, you know, the drought and everything, you know, it's the responsible thing. You know, I think there's a very fine line. You talked about some of the technologies that, you know, as turf managers, as sports turf managers that we use, you know, like here in Bakersfield, we use the Maxicon system, which, you know, it's a great central control based, you know, it's an ET-based irrigation, perfect for us out here in the desert climate.
Cool. Cool.
But you get to the point where, you know, how much is too much? I guess it's, you know, yeah, you know, yeah. Where do we say, okay, this is a good field. It's not a perfect field, but it's a good field. And I think people are hopefully becoming a little more open to that idea with the drought. And I can tell you, we're not receiving the calls that we would normally with the conditions of our fields. They're saying, all right,
they understand.
Yes. Yeah.
That's good. So let me leave you with one last question.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, they're expecting you to cut it by, 36%?
36% from our 2013 use.
Yeah.
Let's say we don't get relief. At what's next? What can you do next to cut back if you have to?
Well, we'll just have to start to eliminate. We'll have to start taking systems out. We'll take out turf and just permanently eliminate it. We're already working with many of our developers here on some of the plans that they have in to rethink some of their landscaping.
Mm-hmm.
We're currently using synthetic in our medians. You know, when I said we
sure.
don't use synthetic, I guess it wasn't accurate. We use it in our medians and stuff because it's aesthetic. It looks great when you're going by it at 45 miles an hour.
Yeah, that's actually not a bad place.
Yeah, and it's very functional, and we don't have to worry about the water. And, you know, there's still maintenance, but, you know, so we are using that. But if this continues, there'll have to be a decision made by the community here in Bakersfield of how far we're going to take this, you know, because we have some great parks. We have 59 parks here in Bakersfield, and some of them are just beautiful parks, open turf areas that people can run and play and do their thing. But if we continue to not have the water available, we're going to have some serious discussions on, okay, where's our priorities? And if we have to cut this water, something's got to give somewhere.
Yeah, it's got to be tough for you to deal with this and look at this because this is your lifeblood. But at the same time, this could become a life and death situation with time. So you've got some tough choices ahead, Darren. And I thank you for taking your time today to join us and fill us in on the very challenging situation that your fields and your staff have to maintain them. You guys are all Diamond Da Vinci's, and we wish you all the best of luck this summer.
All righty. Well, thank you. And if you guys ever get a chance, stop in Bakersfield. Try and do it in
Absolutely.
The winter. Not nearly as hot.
I agree.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Darren.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, guys. Have a great day.
You too.
Well, let's head out from Bakersfield now and head farther south and west to La La Land, to be exact. We're going to visit with Eric Hansen, the Los Angeles Dodgers head groundskeeper, to see how the conditions are in the L.A. Basin and what he does to Dodger Stadium to be as frugal as possible with his watering and whatnot. Eric, good to have you on the show.
Well, very happy to be here.
So tell me what you know, you're in contact, I'm sure, with your other fellow groundskeepers in that area. How bad are things in the LA Basin besides your ballpark at this point?
Well, you know, it's serious. It's really serious. Everybody is, you know, talking about this. You can't open the paper without seeing something new being written about this. Actually, these days, there's nothing new being written. It's just rehashing same old thing. For instance, today's paper, I read this morning before coming in, and you know, three sections has something on the crisis we're in right now. Front page is, you know, there's a picture, and you know, there's in a big article. It says Lawns In. And it talks about California confronting what Nevada has learned in the past. And that goes right to what is happening in California right now. Homeowners and businesses are being encouraged to totally remove their turf grass.
Oh, wow.
Their lawns. In fact, they're incentivizing this. As of right now, in the state, and in the L.A. area, homeowners can receive a rebate up to $3.50 per square foot to remove their turf. Right now, as it stands, they're paying $2 per square foot or $3.50 per square foot for, I believe, the first 1,500 square feet, and then $2 per square foot after that. So I think the math had a little math in here. So if you remove like 2,200 square feet right now, you can get a rebate for over $7,000. So it really incentivizes this, and they're really encouraging it. So
now,
anyway, that's what's happening here.
Do the Dodgers qualify for that rebate?
You know, I think we probably would, but I don't think they'd fly with the players.
You know what? You know what? If ownership found out they could make a lot of money off of it, they wouldn't really care.
We're only talking maybe 8,000 square feet in the infield, so I don't think it's really worth it. And I think, you know, they might be shocked if they came out one day and didn't see any grass on the infield.
Tell me, Eric, what have you done in your situation? At the major league level, it's a lot harder to pull back because you're expected so much to have everything perfect. You're dealing with multi-million dollar players, and safety obviously is a big concern. And it's not just the grass you're worrying about. Of course, the skin is equally important. I don't think anybody realizes that you know, in order to have a proper ball field, water is key, even on the infield dirt. So is there anything that you guys are able to do to back off or conserve, or is it, you know, you've done everything you can at this point?
No, you know, it's our responsibility. I mean, we have the same responsibility everyone else has. We're not entitled. So yes, of course, we're looking for ways to cut back. Yes, it's tough for us at this level, at any level. I mean, we have to balance responsibilities. We have a responsibility, as does everyone, to try to conserve water and look for ways to be more conservation-minded. But on the other hand, I have a responsibility to the players in the organization to provide first and foremost, and you know this, Paul, yeah, and Teresa, safety for the players.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, that for every professional turf manager, sports turf, field manager, you know, I don't think I'm going out on a limb to say our number one responsibility and concern and priority is always participant and player safety. That's number one. You know, that's above playability, and that's definitely above aesthetics. We have to keep it safe out there. And, you know, people enjoy the sport. Everybody understands the game, but what people don't think about at this level is you have a 9-inch hard projectile, that comes off the bat at 100 miles per hour plus, and you have a third baseman or a first baseman that's 90 feet away from that to 110, 120. I challenge anyone, just to visualize that, I challenge anyone to stand in front of that projectile when it bounces 10 feet in front of you and explodes and feel comfortable doing so. I mean, this is completely different than little leaguers or even high schoolers playing out on dry fields.
That's very true.
You know, really, I mean, just stand back and think about that. It's safety is critical. And they count on us having very healthy turf, and that skin has to have moisture in it to cushion that ball, to absorb some of that shock. That ball has to bounce true. I mean, their safety depends on that.
Yeah. The skin is probably the toughest part to keep hydrated too, because, you know, evaporation wise, it certainly evaporates much quicker there than it does on the turf area, because the turf provides some cover and shade to slow that evaporation rate down. Is there anything that you guys use to try and conserve some of that water, say like using a skin tarp, or is that, you know, are you too busy to be able to work with those back and forth during the times, or what kind of things have you been able to put into play?
Well, you know, it's we pretty much, the only way we can do this and try to conserve theirs, kind of modify our practices a little bit. In terms of mm-hmm. the skin tarp, that's a tremendous tool if one can manage that.
Right.
In our situation, we don't use one. I'm still looking at getting one for those times when I can use it. But management is the reason we don't use one. It's plain and simple. Now, when the season is in progress, one of two things is happening. Either we're out there working on the infield and the skin, and we can't have the cover out there, or we have a field event. We can't have the cover out there. So, it's just not manageable for us. But I'm going to continue to look for ways where if I can sneak it on there, put it on there, say a weekend when there really isn't that much going on, and that's a rare occasion, I'll do so. But it is a good tool, and I would encourage anyone that can manage that. That's a great way to conserve moisture in your skin.
Well, and I do know that the numbers of events on Major League ballpark fields is skyrocketing, so I can understand how it's almost impossible to use that tool because there's rarely time when you have more than a day or two of a break that, you know, it makes sense to put it on and to help conserve moisture.
Yeah, and that is correct. In our particular situation, I would say the only time would be maybe one day on the weekend.
Yeah.
That's about the only time, because during the week we're out there working on it if there's no field event.
Sure, sure.
So, you know, now we could put it on at the end of the day when we're done if there's nothing going on, but here again, it's management. Yeah, I mean, rolling that on, rolling it off, you know, that's tough. And at the end of the day, when the team's out of town, we're not like some others. And, you know, there are those that believe that they want to keep their infield skin hydrated all the time. To rehydrate it before mm-hmm. the team comes down is not the best practice, and I don't quarrel with that. I don't do it simply because it's labor intensive and it does use a lot of water.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And I have found that if I start rehydrating the skin a couple of days before the team comes back in, once we get into the homestand, I don't notice any difference in the way the skin plays. But that's my field. That's not someone else's. So I can't speak for them.
Now, you're down in the heart of the irrigation industry down there in the Southwest, or down in Southern California. A lot of the irrigation companies are based out of there. And I'm curious to know, you know, I know Dan Cunningham with the Yankees has been testing a drip irrigation system under his infield over the past several years. Have you ever thought about something like that in your system, or have you talked to people about that? And, you know, I know Dan's had some successes. He hasn't had it quite where he wants it to be yet, and I haven't really talked to him about it in a year or so. But I was just curious if you've seen any kind of advancements in that.
You know, I really haven't. I'm aware of Dan's system. I remember, you know, several years back when he was working on that in Florida, you know, kind of experimenting with that. The reason I really haven't looked into it, you know, I've been here a long time, and I feel like we have dialed in,
sure,
understand our skin, understand best practices in terms of making it play as good as it can possibly play, and we get good feedback. So I'm just one of those that I'm not into making significant changes if what we have works. So that's the reason I really haven't explored that.
I, out of curiosity, you know, we're talking about different, you know, new things that we can try and all of that. Have you noticed an uptick in magical salesmen? Salesmen who have magical products to sell you for sunscreen for your turf, or for magic water protectors, or, you know, just put this in your soil and you'll have to use half the water, we promise.
You know, not to be flip, but, you know, I screen my calls. You know, I I have those that I've worked with this, you know, for a long time that I trust, and we have good relationships. So, you know, I'm not inundated with that type of thing, but I did, you know, talk with the person I work closely with that I buy most of our products from and ask him that very question. And his response was, you know, he's out, you know, servicing, working with the golf course superintendents quite a bit. And mm-hmm. he says, not really. You know, it's the standbys that everyone's still using. You yeah. know, it's, if anything, in the last number of years, there's been an increased use in things like seaweed, kelp, and humic acid products and things like that. But not so much because of their potential to save water, conserve water, but simply because the research is starting to support the value of these products. And here again, I think what's important is our goal as turf managers is to, you know, create a healthy turf. That's our goal. And if our turf is healthy, the input is going to be less. I mean, you have a nice, strong, healthy root system. It's going to have the ability to take up water better than one that is not healthy. So, you know, that's how I approach it. I think most turf managers do as well. It's we want to do what's best for the turf, and in the long run, that's going to help us out. He did tell me as well that it's wetting agents. I mean, we try to use the most appropriate targeted wetting agent for our particular situation. So wetting agents are still huge.
Yeah, especially on a golf course where they don't have regular necessarily irrigation, and so they're developing that crust over their soil.
Right, right.
And the hydrophobic conditions, yeah.
Right. Now, you know, in sand-based systems, LDS, hydrophobic conditions.
Good point.
They're prevalent. The longer you've had, for us, anybody that's had a sand-based system, longer it's been in place, you know, the more likely you are to develop these problems. So wetting agents are critical. You know, in Southern California, it's a little bit off of this. A challenge we have here is the lack of rainfall once we get past April. And what that does to your profile, I mean, back where it rains constantly, you know, where you have a lot of rainfall, you have a natural flush. So the sodium and salts and
those
didn't even think
of
about
things
that.
Are naturally flushed down and away from your root system. We don't have that out here. So that is really a challenge. In the past, when water wasn't such a big issue, I mean, golf course superintendents, they routinely would flush your greens. So that's another challenge out here is finding ways to deal with that.
Do you set your water, your irrigation schedule by eye, by feel, or do you have some more scientific way of doing it?
Well, there's also the art. There's nothing wrong with the art.
That's kind of the look and the feel.
You know, Teresa, that's a part of it. I mean, learning your turf, and not just for us here or at a golf course. It's, in my mind, it's huge for a homeowner. I mean, they need to get out and learn their turf. Mm-hmm. It's not that hard. A little bit of research, you understand. It's not hard to go out and take a look at your turf and see when it's stressing and, you know, when it's not, and try to extend the interval. And, you know, the basic premise with irrigating your turf is, at least on native soils, is deep but infrequent.
Anyway, we
monitor our turf on a daily basis, and that's a part of it. But to your question, we installed a soil moisture sensor system in 2000, summer 2009, and we're using that. And
oh, that's great.
Technology is really advanced. What that allows is, you know, before or if you don't use that, the only way you know what is underneath the turf grass and what the moisture level is to probe it. And we still probe, especially the hydrophobic areas. We'll be probing those. With this system, it allows us in real time, every 10 minutes we get an update, and I access it over the internet.
Wow.
We get an update on the moisture level underneath. And we use that in conjunction with our visual monitoring of the turf to determine our irrigation needs. So it's been very valuable to us. We've been able to reduce, primarily the big benefit for me has been to be able to reduce run times. I
sure.
found out very quickly that, you know, let's just say I was running a zone 10 minutes, that I could back that off to 7. And it was doing, you know, I was doing just as well. So I was conserving 3 minutes of runtime right there per zone. And if you look at that, that was a 180. Now, if I'm running my 360s twice as long to get the same output.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
Even more. So anyway, you know, they go hand in hand. You still have to monitor your turf. And out here, we're on it every day. So.
Right.
Yeah, that's what we're using here.
Well, we appreciate that interesting insight, Eric. It's certainly everybody in California, no matter what level they're maintaining turf, is under tremendous challenges here over the next, at least during the next season of summer. And hopefully relief is coming soon this fall and winter. We'll have to see how that plays out, but I hope for all of you folks that you guys get some relief soon, because this is going to become a life and death situation pretty soon if things don't get a lot better. Hmm. We appreciate you having coming on the show with us today, Eric. Can't say enough how great it was to have you here, and we hope that you and your crew have a great season.
It's been a pleasure, Teresa and Paul, and thank you for having me on.
Thanks.
Hey, and the good part is you don't have to worry about rain delays, you know, where you guys are.
You know, that's one of the upsides.
One of the perks. Yeah, one of the perks. Yeah.
You got it.
Well, my fellow clay bangers, if you have not had a chance to try Beacon Athletics' new sweet spot tamp, you really are missing out on experience, and I mean that. We opened our Little League park this past weekend, which I am involved with, and it really was my first chance this year to use the tamp. And let me tell you, this tamp is like comfort food. It's just so smooth and so comfortable to operate. The vibration is gone. There's no jarring of the arm when you don't hit that tamp squarely on the mark. And that's because of that articulating tamp head on the sweet spot. It automatically adjusts it for you. The shifting weight and the damping system on the base of the turf on the tamp handle, it prevents the recoil, and that ensures all the energy of that tamp stroke goes right into the ground. My Little League crew, which they were the people who tested that tamp for us all last year, they were talking about how it feels like you don't even have to work hard when you're tamping with the sweet spot. As soon as they began using that production model that we had this year, they had said they had forgotten how great the tamp felt from last year when they were testing it. So another cool part about this tamp is that it's got interchangeable heads. So you buy one tamp handle and you can get as many as 4 different heads, from a 10x10 to an 8x8, a 6x6 or a 6x4 tamp head. And it's really quick and easy to change. So don't you think your crewmates deserve to enjoy tamping like we do? I think so. If you get a chance, check out our video on the Beacon Athletics website telling all about the tamp. You can find that video at www.beaconathletics.com, or you can call Beacon at 800-747-5985, and you can personally talk to me about it. Excuse me if I gush about it, because this tool is that good. The Beacon Sweet Spot Tamp System.
Paul.
Yes.
Geek alert.
Oh, good night. That always scares me.
I know, we need a klaxon horn or something going off to warn you, and hopefully our listeners don't feel that they need to be warned. But
I guess it takes all kinds, doesn't it?
All kinds of geeks, baby.
Yeah.
So, folks, this is our Turfgrass Science segment. If you've got a better name for that, we'll take it. But until then, Turfgrass Science is what we're calling it. This is where I get to sit down and geek out about turfgrass. And actually, I like to geek out about the physiology of the turfgrass. I like the study of what happens inside of the plant. Paul, what part of the turf management process do you geek out about? I mean, you geek out about tamps, clearly, but...
I like dirt.
That's right. I forgot.
Look, I'm a soils guy. I was brought up in the soils end of the business, and so that's my thing.
I always I joke when I'm out, you know, giving a talk or something. I always say once we get down to the soil, that's where my knowledge ends. But no,
I like the smell of the grass when you mow it.
Oh. So, I think we all do.
I mean, yeah, you know, I majored in turf, but our at the University of Wisconsin where I went to school, you know, the major for the turf students was anchored in the soil science department. So, so I got a lot more soils, and I'll never forget when I was going through school there. I thought, what in the hell am I going to do with all this soil science, information? I'm supposed to be learning about turf, and you know, little did I know. Further on down the line that soil science that I got was really important from a baseball end, especially and dealing with infields of having the knowledge of the soils.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. That's, you know, I joke about where my knowledge ends, but it really is just as important. But today we're going to talk about drought and turf grass. And actually, in what we'll do every week is we will post our show notes on what?
Every show, you mean? Not every week,
oh,
every
gosh.
Show.
Every show, sorry. Oh, thank goodness it's not every week.
I don't think you could handle it every week.
I don't think I could. But every show, we will be posting our show notes, the notes that Paul and I work off of. And included in that will be links to different tools or different papers or other sources around the web that we found that we use to help build the show. And this week, or this show, what we have is a paper, and it is by Ali Haravandi and James Baird and a couple of others out of the University of California in the Division of Agriculture and Natural Resources. The paper is called Managing Turf Grasses During Drought. And Paul, actually, you found this, and it's quite interesting. I know we've done a lot of focus in California today, but that's because, you know, these guys have been dealing with this the longest. They really are focusing their efforts on learning more about how to handle things during these conditions. And even if we're not suffering through, you know, extreme drought or severe drought, or what was that worst, what do they call it when it's the worst again?
Exceptional.
Exceptional,
yes.
Drought. We do go through droughty periods. We go through 2-3 years where we're droughty. We go through 1 year where we're droughty. Doesn't matter. We can learn from all of this. So.
Yeah, it was. If you recall, it was just a couple of years ago, 2012, that we had that massive drought all throughout the Midwest and in the entire agricultural area, and a good chunk of the nation went through it then, and that was pretty serious.
It was. It was. So let's take a look at this paper. They go through a lot of interesting concepts about how grasses respond to different irrigation regimes. I thought this was probably one of the more interesting parts and one of the pieces that we could apply throughout the entire country more readily. What surprised me the least was that warm season grasses are better at using less water than cool season grasses are. That's not a shocker. It's something we all learned in our basic turf
really. And you know that those plants are, when you think about it common sense wise, they're a much more succulent plant than the northern grasses are. So
absolutely.
It's pretty easy to make sense of that, to understand that part.
Well, it's partially that, and here's a geek alert. The other part of it is that they process photosynthesis differently, and it allows them to close their guard cells, and they don't have to utilize as much water in order to keep everything up and running. So that's kind of cool too. Were you going to make fun of me for being?
I was just
going
to say that those southern grasses are just showing off to the northern grasses.
Yeah, that's what it is. But what was really cool and what was the most surprising to me is that they showed that both warm season grasses and cool season grasses have a reduction in overall water usage when they're irrigated to what they call is a deficit, which means it's kind of like when we're thinking about fertilization, when you don't over fertilize, when you keep the grass lean and mean with your fertilizer, you're not providing too much succulents so that the disease wants to take over. It's kind of the same idea. It's just enough water for the plant to be able to survive and do well, but not so much water that they start apparently getting spoiled rotten and wasting water.
Sure.
So, yeah, that was really interesting.
And especially going through the drought that we just went through in 2012, as I think about what happened then, we had weeks and weeks of no rain. And I was trying to keep our we were struggling just to keep our turf in halfway decent shape on our Little League fields. And it was everything I could do just to give it enough water just to stay green. It wasn't growing much. It just because you just couldn't keep up with it. The humidities were so dry and just sucking everything out. So,
yeah.
And we all worried. We all worried whether it was going to come back. And it's amazing the resiliency of turf grass in a drought and how it can come back with just getting just little bits of water to just keep that crown alive.
Mm-hmm. And that's really the key is letting that help keeping that crown alive, but also not overdoing it. If you've got a grass that likes to go dormant when it gets dry, talk to management and tell, work through it and discuss what happens when that goes on so that you're not over stressing the grass and you're letting it go dormant if it needs to without trying to push it too hard. Although it's rare that we get the opportunity to do that. So instead what we need to look at is finding a better way to irrigate and keep it going without overdoing it. So, sorry, we got off topic on topic, but the other part of this is they were looking at, and actually, this is at the end of the paper. I'm going to skip back to the beginning or the middle in a minute here. But they were looking at the root system and talking about different infiltration rates and the way that there's a difference in the soil texture, sandy versus clay, which most of us are pretty familiar with. And then they go into the rooting depth. One of the best ways to protect your grass from droughty conditions is to make sure that you have a strong root system, and the deeper and the more prolific the roots, the more roots you have, the better off you are. When Paul and I were discussing this paper off air, I was surprised at what they listed as the rooting depths. They have Kentucky bluegrass listed at half an inch to 1.5 inch rooting depth. And I'm not used to thinking of Kentucky bluegrass that way, Paul. Why is that?
Well, for a couple of things, of course. When I look at it, when I was managing grass at Oriole Park, again, in yards, of course, we had a sand-based field, and I'd have, 10 inches of roots. But even there, when I had 10 inches of roots, when you'd go into the seasons of July and August with the high temperatures, what happens? You get root sloughing, and a lot of those roots die back, where the plant just keeps enough roots to keep itself alive. And our roots would go from 10 inches in 1 week down to about 3 or less.
Yeah.
And on native soil fields, like our Little League fields, usually I'm lucky if I can get 3 inches or more of root. But during the hot summer months, again, that root sloughing as the soil temperatures increase, especially during a really hot summer, like you get in a drought, there's definitely a pretty huge reduction in roots as that plant sloughs off that excess roots as it claims it is.
Yeah.
And just keeps what it absolutely needs.
It pulls out the extra sugars and stuff that it needs to stay alive and gets rid of the dead weight. It just doesn't need it anymore.
Yeah.
And actually, as we look closer at this, the table, it's table 5 in the paper, it's approximate root depths of common California turf grasses under normal use conditions. Well, good luck defining that. And but what that means to me is that we're talking about native soil versus sand-based. And we're also talking about middle to low fertilization practices, not the high fertilization practices many of our listeners might be used to. Even middle to high is going to give you a totally different rooting depth than what we're looking at here.
Right. And that is the key. The key is proper fertilization program to build up that root mass so that when you go into the summer, you're ready for that. If you've got a good aggressive, at least for the cool season grasses, if you have a good aggressive fall fertilization program, you can really build up a heck of a root system that can withstand those kind of droughts. Now, obviously, the root growth period in Purina grass is different than it is in bluegrass and ryegrass.
Absolutely. Yep. So, well, the other thing they talked about was looking at getting your mowing heights fixed. There's a lot to do with that. Part of it is that when you mow the grass, you open it up and you tend to lose water from those open wounds. We wound the grass every time we mow it. So if you mow less, you wound it less often and you lose less water that way. And also, if you've got a greater leaf surface area, you've got more area for photosynthesis to take place, and you've got more area for water storage to take place. Now, they were talking about keeping Kentucky bluegrass, and this just kills me because I'm not used to this, at 1.5 to 2 inches in height. And I guess I've gotten spoiled being up here in Minnesota. That just seems so high to me. But, Paul, you said that you have kept it that high on your minor league field, yeah?
On our little league fields, yeah. You have to remember the difference. You know, you're used to thinking at a professional level. You know, you think that the professional line where we're keeping it around an inch for the cool season grasses. And, you know, if you get down to the lower levels, you know, below minor league, where you're talking high school, college, some colleges, but especially park and rec and those kind of things, you're going to be,
it's much higher.
We're fast. We have a fast infield for our little league. You know, we're about an inch and a half, but our outfield's 2 inches, which is still pretty tight and still actually pretty fast.
Yeah.
You know, when you consider what they're playing at, most high schools and parks are going to be taller than that. But, you know, the one thing I wanted to talk about that it mentions in this paper is that there is such a thing as being too tall of grass, because the grass will also use too much water if you have it too high. So there is this
balance,
fine line. Yeah, there's this balance of having it too high and using too much water and cutting it too short and sacrificing too much of the roots.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that, for cool season grass, of course, you're in that between 1 and 3 inch range, depending on the variety or the type of grass that you're growing, rather.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. Well, they also mentioned that Bermuda grasses and warm season grasses are going to be happier, you know, between about 0.5 inch to 1 inch. Of course, when you start getting into your St. Augustine and your seashore paspalum, that changes a little bit. It definitely check out the paper to see what they're recommending for California, and take that with a grain of salt and remember where you are versus where they are in terms of general climate, and make adjustments as needed.
And the levels that you're managing too.
Yes.
The levels of play.
Yep. They also go into some good information about irrigation auditing. And I can't go into this because we're running out of time. Actually, in the show notes, I will have a couple of links about irrigation auditing, including some different tools and calculators that can help you go through this. But it's a very complex procedure. All right. That sounds bad. Like, scary. It's not that kind of complex. It just takes some planning to get it done right. But when you get it done right, you account for all of the variability within your irrigation system. And it allows you to set just the right amount of number, just the right amount of irrigation timing to make sure that you get the right amount of water without too much, without too little. And we will also have a link to a paper by Pam Sherritt an article by Pam Sherritt from Ohio State, and that was in Sports Field Management magazine. And she goes into a wonderful explanation and walks you through how to do that irrigation audit. And using both of those, or all of those tools, I think you can pretty much walk yourself through it. Although, you know, I wouldn't be opposed to doing a podcast about how to do an irrigation audit. I got to tell you guys, it's kind of difficult to do without a whiteboard in front of me that I can start drawing pictures on. That tends to run a little bit easier. They also have the general, you know, fertilization practice recommendation of keeping it lean and mean, like we were talking about earlier. You don't want it growing too much, because as you grow more, you need to utilize more water. And, you know, we're trying to keep that down. But it reads very easily and provides excellent description on how the plants actually are utilizing water and how we can think about the plants differently so that we can help them utilize water better. Well, I think that's as good a place to stop as any. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I think that pretty much puts the show in the books, and not a moment too soon, because frankly, I'm getting a little parched talking about all this droughts, and I could use a little rehydration.
Ha-ha! Excellent, sir. That was my impression of Ed McMahon from the Johnny
Carson
lame. Show.
You got to get a lot lower. Go, ho, 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 that kind of thing. That's a Johnny Carson. Or that's an Ed McMahon laugh, if you ask me.
If I could do that, you should be scared. I'm a girl.
Well, be sure to tune in next time to Diamond Images for more talk about ball field groundskeeping. And the best part is, it's all free, you see, because that's the kind of deal we're going to strike up for you.
Aren't we nice? Our official webpage for the show can be found at beaconathletics.com/podcast. There you can find our show notes, which I've talked about. We'll have any papers and links and photos, anything that we've discussed during an episode. And you can get some background information on who we're talking to as well. We'll also have our pictures and bios up there if you happen to be curious about who you're listening to. Woo! And we'll also put up some bonus material. You know, if our interviews go long, we'll put the extra stuff up there too.
Isn't that called stalking?
It might be.
Well, we'd love to hear from you folks. Either way, you can email Teresa or myself at podcast@beaconathletics.com, where you can send us a question or comment on our show today, good or bad. And if you have any show ideas, go ahead and send them along to us too.
And if you like Twitter, our Twitter handle is @DiamondDaVincis. That's @DiamondDaVincis. We're not crazy active there, but we will be sharing, you know, more links and a lot of the stuff that we find while we're preparing for the show. So extra bonus material there as well. And you can always ask us questions there too.
And of course, remember that the Diamond DaVincis podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. Check us out on the web at www.beaconathletics.com. That's it for me. We'll see you next time.
That's right. Adios.